Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Life Science Rundown. My name is Nicholas Katman, and I'm with the FDA Group. Before we jump into our discussion for today, just a little bit about the FDA Group. We help life science companies in the areas of quality assurance, regulatory affairs, clinical operations, commissioning, qualification, and validation, as well as consulting around manufacturing and engineering. We offer three different engagement models, which are consulting, staff augmentation, and full-time employee recruitment. So if you ever find yourself in need, just head over to thefdagroup.com, check us out, and get in touch. So today I am speaking with Dennis Wishern. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, good morning, Nicholas.
Good morning. Thanks for joining me. So before we get into the topic of DEA, could you just kind of introduce yourself and your background?
Yes, sir. I'm a retired DEA agent with a little over 30 years of government service. Started out like most DEA agents doing various drug investigations, predominantly methamphetamine and heroin. And as I moved around the country, I ended up in the Midwest in Indiana in 2005, and I became acutely aware of the different rules the DEA has on prescription drugs. Like hydrocodone, oxycodone, and drugs like that, or even benzodiazepine. So for the last 15 years up until my retirement, I focused on those drugs because of the problems they were causing in America.
Where are we today with that?
You know, I think we're in a better place now, Nick, than we were, let's say, in the 2000s. But there's still diversion of drugs. That's when they're misused and things like that. And with the various nationwide opioid lawsuits and the increased government scrutiny, there's definitely more focus on the prescribing, the manufacturing, and the distributing of these types of prescription drugs, primarily the benzos and the opioids.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned some illegal drugs, and then you also talked about pharmaceutical products. For those companies that deal with and handle and market controlled substances, what are some of the things that you believe are very important for them to know about how to handle those and interact with the DEA?
Well, first of all, there's much more of a heightened sense or review of those manufacturing and distributors. The nationwide opioid lawsuits have really raised the bar, and the government has actually increased their investigations and prosecutions when a manufacturer, distributor, or a registrant, as DEA calls it, that's a licensed person that's authorized to handle controlled substances. But these type of registrants need strong compliance programs, strong record-keeping programs, and then even more so, stronger suspicious order monitoring programs in light of all these recent lawsuits, Nick.
Mm-hmm. Now, my background and expertise is in FDA regulations. What I've found is that there seems to be a common thread among people that run into issues with FDA. It's kind of, you see a lot of the same reoccurring issues. What are some of those issues that are kind of commonplace when people run into issues with the DEA?
Great analogy there, Nick. The most common ones that the DEA registrants run into are poor record keeping and poor security. So for instance, a little background, the FDA, if my memory serves me correct, has notably been approving all of the U.S. medicines for over 100 years. DEA's part is only a small part. It is the security and record keeping of the controlled substances only. And the controlled substances versus the non-controlled in America is around 80 to 20, 80% non-controlled, 20% control. DEA's sole authority is over the controls. And then, as I said, I just mentioned DEA's sole authority. They don't decide what's medicine like the FDA chemists and scientists do. DEA's part is only the security and record keeping. And in my days at DEA, we too saw people that got in trouble were weak or did not focus on the security and record keeping of their controlled substances.
What are some of the negative consequences if people run into issues with those record keeping and things of that sort?
Well, it always depends on the facts, but generally if it's a first time occurrence, DA might issue a letter of admonition, and that's more or less like a warning speeding ticket. Hey, you're deficient here, correct this. We're going to come back in a year and be sure your records are better, your security's better, your processes are better. Now, for a second or third offense, let's say it happened again in the next year or two, there's a possibility of a civil fine. And the civil fine is levied against that DA registrant. And again, DA registrant is just somebody that's got a DA license that's authorized by DA to actually handle controlled substances. And that civil fine could be levied if the U.S. Attorney's Office believes in the violation in a significant amount, and it's a significant type of error or poor record keeping. And then DA also has the authority, and it's rarely used, but it is used in some occasions where DA can take their license back, and that person could no longer handle or distribute, manufacture, control substances.
Mm-hmm.
But that's usually at the very end.
And you said that's happened, but it's a rare occurrence.
Yes, sir. It happens more with a practitioner who's also, you know, like a provider, that occurs more often. But some manufacturers, and if I think back in my history, there's been a couple small manufacturers in the Midwest and a couple pharmacies that have lost their DA licenses, but never for a first-time offense. Never for a first-time offense.
So if somebody were to lose their license, what's the process they have to go through in order to regain that license?
Well, of course, there's due process, but it's, you know, you have to petition DA, you gotta go through the law process, you're gonna have to hire an attorney, and you're gonna have to actually try and get it back through the courts and things like that. But again, I want to stress, if DA does move against a license, it's usually on multiple offenses and something very serious to take that drastic of a measure to do that.
Are there other consequences that tend to follow that? Because I'm imagining the severity could lead to issues where somebody might be at risk of going to prison. Is that an accurate statement or not?
That's possible. It all depends on the evidence. It's kind of hard to give a great example without, you know, one fact can change so many things. But most licensing issues are administrative in nature, where it's just a loss of a license. And depending on the number of violations, it could be a large civil fine. There's been some large healthcare organization, hospital organizations that have been fined by the government several million dollars in the last few years. But the criminal nature really only comes in if that organization's doing something out the back door, such as a pill mill or something like that. You don't see it too much in the manufacturer distributor sides, the criminal cases. Most of the criminal cases are against solo providers, like a doctor or a nurse provider, something like that. But usually on the other side, mostly administrative and civil, Nick. But every now and then, it's possible.
Okay. So let's say I'm a pharmaceutical company and I decide to enter into this space. Let's say I purchased an asset. It's a controlled substance. This is all brand new to me. You know, what are kind of the first things that a company like that would need to do? And what are some of the pitfalls that they need to be aware of and try to avoid in the beginning stages?
Yes, sir. Great question. Three things come quickly to mind. One is, does the organization that you purchased, does it have the necessary security? All of the drug security requirements DA has were actually made in the Code of Federal Regulations in the early 70s by Congress. And it's my belief they copied the U.S. banking system when they did it. Mm. Let me give you an example of that. One is if you maintain Schedule II drugs, you need to keep them in a bank-type vault. I'm talking 8 inches of concrete, rebar, and things like that. The next schedules, 3 through 5s, you only need to have in a locked cage. So the first one is, do you have the necessary security and is it updated to prevent diversion or theft? Two is your record-keeping system compliant? And again, I often tell my clients, think check register. And what I mean by that is, can you account for all the drugs that come in and out of your facility? And do you have the records? If DEA were to show up, can you produce those records in a reasonable amount of time? Because commonly DEA will show up and do an audit, and they're just going to check, do all your numbers match? So the same way mine and your bank account on any given day, we know how much is in it. That's what Congress gave DEA the authority to check. And then lastly, in light of the nationwide opioid lawsuits, there's an increased focus on suspicious order monitoring. And in essence, that just means due diligence and compliance. Are you selling to legitimate people at the normal amount? Because of the basis for the nationwide opioid lawsuits is they blame many DEA registrants that they weren't double checking on who they were selling it to or the amounts were excessive. So you need to have a current SOM program, that's the acronym for suspicious order monitoring, that you're selling to the people that are legitimate and they're taking care of business. So those three things come to mind right off the top of my head.
Well, you said legitimacy, you said the amount, and what was the third thing?
Or the prospective buyers, your clients, are they legitimate? Are they selling normal amounts, which is hard to determine at times, but—
Well, that's the path I was going down is, on the topic of legitimacy and amount, how do I evaluate if somebody is quote unquote legitimate? And then to follow on that, how do I determine if the amount is reasonable or excessive?
And that's the toughest thing. The regulation that Congress made is somewhat vague in my opinion, and it's almost 50 years old. But A, you wanna be sure that it's a legitimate company. So you wanna do their due diligence. Does it have a history? Do they have any complaints? Are they located in one particular time? It just kind of runs the gamut. It's almost like you have to do a background search if you're doing controlled substances on who you're selling it to. And then as far as the determination, are they buying in the proper amount? So for instance, in the average pharmacy sells somewhere between, out of all the prescription drugs they sell on a yearly basis, somewhere around 15% are controls, 85 are non-controls. So if you were to take on a pharmacy client, let's say for instance, that was doing 80% controls and 20 non-controls, you'd really want to take a look at that in today's climate. But maybe they just focused on nursing homes or something like that, or just pain practices. It could be legitimate, but you have to determine that. And I've known my other clients, they've kind of stratified, hey, a small pharmacy, for instance, will have this amount of drugs they'll, distribute in a year. A mid-size will have this amount, and then a large one will have this amount. So you can kind of determine what an average amount is. And then of course you have to watch for the suspect drugs, and those are the most diverted, and that's the opioids and the benzos. So there's a way to do it. It's a little gray at times, and it's gray of me trying to explain it, but there's a way to do it. You want to have a process. So in case government ever looks at you, you can defend your process and the amounts you determine.
Okay. So it sounds like it's taken on a case by case basis, and there's a good faith effort to determine if the amounts were excessive or not. And as long as there's a justification that is reasonable, then you're okay. But if there's something that's completely out of whack, it's pretty easily identified.
That's a fair way to say it. And you used a great word there, Nick, good faith. You have to have a process. You have to defend it. And, we're all human. Mistakes are going to be made. but you can't stick your head in the sand nowadays either.
How often do DEA conduct audits and inspections, and how do they determine where they go? How do they prioritize?
Well, that's always somewhat changing, but DEA does, just like you said, cyclic investigations or cyclic audits on the diversion side. Now, I want to give you a quick little background. I'm a former DEA agent. You know, I've done the meth labs and the heroin cases and things like that. And I know the administrative side of DEA that focuses on the prescription drugs too. But there's a small amount of DEA. There's around 500 DEA diversion investigators, and those are the investigators that come out. But to answer your question specifically, they have yearly cyclic investigations. So let's say if you were in New Jersey, DEA is going to go into those large manufacturers every year and check their security and their books. Now, if you're a small pharmacy, let's say somewhere out in the Midwest, DEA might never visit you at all, but they could if there's a complaint. And if you're a DEA doctor, there's over, I think, 1.3 million DEA registered doctors. DEA will probably never visit that. So DEA's focus is primarily on the large manufacturers and the large distributors, and they're usually in those facilities every year or at least every other year.
Excellent. You mentioned some of your clients. What is the profile of somebody that would seek your support? And do they tend to seek you prior to issues with DEA or following issues with the DEA?
You know, a little bit of both, but to answer your question, it's when they have a problem. But let me give you a couple examples on that. I routinely help pain providers, and those are pain physicians who are afraid to prescribe opioids now because of the heightened awareness of opioids. So I've been around the country helping those ladies and gentlemen. A small portion call me ahead of time, and I'll actually go in and review their books, check their processes and things like that from a DEA standpoint. I have no medical training. All my training is on the job experience, the do's and the don'ts and the war stories. I also help out pharmacies if there's a DEA issue, but that's usually when DEA is looking at them after there's a loss of drugs. I'll go in, review their processes, help them try and tighten up their policies and give them what I believe good advice to prevent that occurrence from ever happening again. I also work with hospitals on the same regard if there's an issue or things like that, if there's a loss of drugs. So most of mine is a loss of drugs, or if you're a prescriber, the fear of DEA intervention because you're prescribing opioids for pain. So a little bit of everything, but most of mine is focused on the prescribers, the pharmacies, and the hospital organizations. And then the small distributors too, if they just want a good double check that their processes and things like that. And I'm starting to get calls on the SOM side because Congress did change those rules. And again, that's suspicious order monitoring. They have to have a program nowadays because of the heightened opioids and things like that.
And when you go in and help these clients, is it generally, are you wearing a consultant hat, or are there instances where you'll actually create a mock DEA inspection?
I do both, actually. But I usually act as a consultant, but I want my clients and to have the confidence to go through it, because usually when DEA shows up anywhere, there's this huge fear by the DEA registrant or the client, you know, and it's like, but I want to walk them through what to expect. I build what I call a customized book that they actually, I call it the rapid response book. And that's just to take the fear out. They have all their records in this book. So when DEA would knock on their door, they're ready. They're completely ready. I can decrease their stress. I can decrease their fear, and I can give them that comfort. Like, hey, if they ever do show up, you're good to go. Here's how to respond. You're fully compliant. You have nothing to worry about. So that's really my goal when I go out there.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know if there's any kind of hidden tips and tricks that people need to know when they're interacting with the DEA. So I'll give you an example. I went to a conference and there was a speaker talking about how to interact with the FDA, and he wanted to make a point. So I'll actually play this game with you, Dennis, right? So I'm the FDA and I'm going to talk to you, okay? So Dennis, do you know what this is?
Yes, sir. So I have a writing instrument.
Oh, you almost had it. I didn't add the that's the wrong answer. The correct answer was the first one, which is yes, sir. I didn't ask you what it was. I said, do you know what this is, right? And so that's kind of the tip and trick, is answer exactly what the FDA is asking, and don't kind of, people tend to get caught up in issues when they ramble on, right? So
very true.
Yeah. So I'm just kind of curious to know, are there little tips and tricks that little golden nuggets that people might be interested in hearing when they're going through a DEA inspection?
Yes. The couple ones that stand out is you always want your best extroverted person to interact with DEA that's knowledgeable. Don't put a rookie up there. And just like you mentioned, Nick, we used to call that diarrhea of the mouth. It's like, answer the question,
right,
and things like that. Be prepared, but find somebody extroverted, and the world's not coming to an end, that DEA's coming. But if you have your policies and your programs up to date, and you should always update them every year, and you have good records, you have nothing to fear from DEA, okay? And then if there is a loss of drugs, that happens. As long as you can document it, learn from it, make the necessary changes and things like that, it happens. There's human nature. But the biggest thing is act, you know, they're the government. They're going to win out at the end, probably. Try and break bread if you can, but have a good basic understanding of what they're after and their focus, okay? A lot of times people say, hey, they're kind of inferring I'm prescribing inappropriately. DEA doesn't have the authority to tell a doctor how to prescribe. Their authority is only on the security and the record keeping of drugs. However, if the doctor's running a pill mill and it's going out the back door and things like that, DEA is going to be aware of that, and they're going to look strongly at that. So, but put your best foot forward, and at the same time, have somebody that's more extroverted than introvert. Okay.
Excellent. Some of the support that we provide in terms of FDA regards lawsuits. So being expert witnesses on cases, is that something that you've done in your career?
Yes, sir. I've been involved on one part of the nationwide opioid lawsuits and yes, I definitely have the expertise on that.
Okay, excellent. What is your knowledge in terms of the interactions between DEA and FDA? Are there interactions? Is there an overlap? And if so, what does that look like?
Yes, sir. Great question. Again, DEA's authority is different than the FDA. So I'll give you an example. If the FDA were to approve a non-controlled substances, DEA has no authority. I often say DEA doesn't have a dog in that fight. Now, let's say a new opioid is developed. It's got to be approved by the FDA. And if and when it's ever approved, it then goes over to DEA. And there's a partnership with DEA and the FDA to decide what schedule of drugs it goes into. So for instance, almost all of the opioids are Schedule II. So that's kind of locked and loaded and you know, that's where they go, except buprenorphine. And buprenorphine is a lower potency type of opioid, and that's a Schedule III. So one of the big MAT drugs is buprenorphine, but there's also a recent buprenorphine that was approved by the FDA that's a Schedule III. So most of them go in, but it's a partnership with DEA and the FDA to put it in a drug schedule. There's five drug schedules. Schedule 1's the one that the FDA's decided have no legitimate medical value. And then it goes all the way to Schedule 5, which is still a scheduled drug, but it has less potency or need to be diverted. So
could you actually go through the different schedules? Because I've heard that terminology, and people say Schedule 1, and I look at that and I don't know, is that the worst? Is it the best? Schedule 5, so on and so forth. So could you kind of just walk me through the different schedules?
Yes, sir. Schedule 1 is the definition off the top of my head is it's a drug that have no legitimate medical value or need. So examples of that are heroin, illicit fentanyl, marijuana, LSD, and there's a few other ones, some of these offshoot ones. I'm going to come back to the marijuana one because that could get people like, hey, what do you mean? Why? Blah, blah, blah. Schedule 2 drugs have legitimate medical value. All of those opioids that I discussed, hydrocodone, pharmaceutical grade fentanyl, morphine, methadone, oxycodone, they all have legitimate medical value, but they're highly suspect for diversion and misuse too. So they're placed in that Schedule 2 status. And then the security, you have to have more security if you're a manufacturer distributor. All right, Schedule 3 drugs. Most steroids are all Schedule 3s. Buprenorphine's a Schedule 3. I believe ketamine's a Schedule 3 too. So it's a less diverted, less abused drug, but it still can be abused. Mm. And then you go into Schedule 4s. Tramadol is a great one for Schedule 4. Most benzodiazepines are Schedule 4. So they're not, let's say, as potently diverted and misused as the Schedule 2s, but they are. And then the Schedule 5 drugs are like, I believe, a particular brand of drug with codeine, so Schedule 5. So they're still scheduled, they're slightly misused, but they're kind of like the least of the worst. But go on, Nick.
Well, I want you to continue, but I just wanted to clarify the way I'm understanding it is the more abused it is, the lower on the scale, meaning ones and twos, and the ones that are abused but less often are the fours and the fives. Is that accurate?
That's a very fair way to say it, Nick.
Okay. And I interrupted you. What was the point that you were going to make afterwards?
I was just going to finish up on the marijuana one because I'm out there, you know, I speak around the country and things like that. And I believe in the American vote and things like that. But the reason marijuana is still Schedule 1, and I'm not dumping this on the FDA, the FDA has never approved marijuana in the smoke form as medicine. So if it's not approved by the DEA has to put it in a Schedule 1 status, okay? There's actually little known fact, there's a drug called Marinol that's actually has THC in it. It's a Schedule 3 drug and it's in a pill form. So there's actually a thought process why marijuana is still Schedule 1. Many people don't want to understand it. They don't understand the metrics, but it's really the FDA for 100 years, I'm speaking where you used to work, has approved all medicines, and there's a process and a way and the whole hierarchy how that's done. DEA only concerned about security and the record keeping, but it works in concert to put it in the schedules with the FDA.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, this was super informative, and I really appreciate all the clarifications. What are some things that you think are important to end with? What remaining questions do you think the audience might have that you want to touch on?
You know, the biggest thing is pharmaceutical drugs are necessary in America. They help patients across the country. And you should not be afraid of prescribing them, distributing, or manufacturing them. But in the same regard, you want to have tight programs, you want to have a tight compliance, and you want to be aware of the changes, the recent changes regarding suspicious order monitoring. So if somebody were to knock on your door, whether it's FDA or DEA, that your program stand up, you have a good faith program, and you're taking care of business. And that's what I tell my clients.
Fantastic. Well, I really appreciate the time, Dennis. And as always, if the audience finds conversations like this valuable, please share it with a colleague or your professional network. If you haven't already, subscribe to get updates of new episodes at thefdagroup.com/podcast and follow the FDA Group on LinkedIn. If you'd like to connect about project or resource needs, head over to thefdagroup.com and get in touch, or feel free to connect with me personally on LinkedIn. So thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.